How does an everyday law practice relate to Jesus' call to follow him to servanthood? Hello and welcome to the God Story Podcast. I'm Brent Siddle. My very special guest on the show this time is Robert Cochran Jr., who's the author of a new IVP America book called The Servant Lawyer, Facing the Challenges of Christian Faith and Everyday Law Practice. Robert is the Brandeis Professor of Law Emeritus at Pepperdine University and a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law. Following law school, he clerked, they say in the States, I think, and clerked if you're in the UK and New Zealand. He clerked or clerked, and did both probably, for Judge John A. Field on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals and practiced with the law firm of Boyd and Bain in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Robert joins me now from the States. Robert, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Brad. I've looked forward to this. It's nice to meet you online.
And it's nice to meet you too, sir. And I've loved your book. Very, very profound and lots of stuff to talk about. Now, you write, when one thinks of a lawyer generally, servant is not the first word that comes to mind. Now, why and how is a lawyer a servant of Christ?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me what is the first word that comes to mind, but I'll leave that to your listeners' imagination. Well, I perceive lawyers as servants, or lawyers should be servants, in two ways. I think lawyers should be servants to individual clients, and I mean by servant in a bigger context. I mean, but basically, you're meeting the need of a client, just as a servant who brings you a meal or cares for you in other ways meets a need. And of course, from the Christian perspective, that's grounded in agapic love and a great vehicle for a Christian. The broader context, I think, is that that lawyers are servants of society generally. Almost every type of practice is in some significant way designed to reinforce the rule of law. Prosecutors, obviously, or so, they're prosecuting criminals. But criminal defense attorneys are holding prosecutors to their to restraints, protecting client rights. A personal injury lawyer is seeking an injured person's rights, but an insurance lawyer in those cases holding the plaintiff's lawyer to the rule of law. And even corporate lawyers and business lawyers, they're advising clients, they're drafting articles in corporation and other documents. And they do so within the confines of the law. And so they're holding clients to the law. And I think the rule of law is extremely important, and the lawyer's means of serving the broader public is in reinforcing the rule of law. Now, law is not always just. You may want to probe into that a little bit later on, but I'll leave the questioning to you.
I'll do my best, sir. How did you personally, as a young lawyer, learn to see clients as people that God has brought into your life?
Well, it was really through a professor. His name was Tom Schaefer, who taught at the University of Virginia for a year, my third year, and I really see it as providential that he came. He'd been the dean at Notre Dame Law School. And he did a course on religion and law, and that was the way he would with a sort of a wink in his eye, he'd ask students, how do you define the client? And we'd all think back about professional ethics and technical definitions. Do you need a contract, etc.? He said that for the Christian, the client should be defined as this person God has brought into my life.
How do lawyers help exercise dominion over the world?
Well, of course, the notion of dominion is rooted in God's command at creation that we, as his creation, are to exercise dominion. Some people see that as dominating the world and sort of using the world, but properly understood, it's a matter of protecting and defending the world. And lawyers advise clients, particularly business clients, who are really all about expanding their influence into the world. That can be done well or that can be done poorly. And lawyers are in the business context typically part of a team. And as I mentioned earlier, are responsible for holding clients within legal requirements, but business practice is typically a matter of trying to figure out how to do things, create services, create products that give people jobs and care for people.
Why do you argue that it's important for lawyers to love their clients? I like that.
Well, it sort of comes in a startling way, I think, to most people that lawyers would love clients. Of course, I'm speaking here as a Christian of agapic love. It's not romantic love. It's not necessarily friendship, but it's a love that looks for out for the best for this other person, and that may be caring. Very often is caring for somebody who's suffered greatly, who's facing the most challenging situation they've faced in their life and are in great need. Sometimes, I mean, maybe with a business client, it might be challenging the clients to care for workers or care for others. Agapic love is a much broader concept than a lot of people perceive it to be. And I think that's the best way to think about clients. Loving your clients can be a challenge, though. I mean, I think oftentimes the pressure is to distance yourself from your clients to kind of protect yourself. And lawyers do need to bring a level of objectivity to the relationship. That's one of the things they're paid for. The client's all wrapped up emotionally in a case. And a lawyer needs to be able to step back from the situation and provide some clarity to the client's situation. But I think that's all a part of agapic love.
You write a lot in the book about restorative justice, and restorative justice is something that we're hearing more and more about these days, certainly where I am in New Zealand. What's your view of restorative justice?
Well, I'm a big fan of restorative justice. It's really a relatively new concept, but also an ancient concept. But within the world, within the Western world, where we more commonly think of retributive justice, we don't use terms like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but often that's the notion that we have to punish the criminal at the level at which he's caused harm to someone else. And I think even within restorative justice, there's a place for punishment. But restorative justice recognizes that there are more people that have been impacted by the defendant's action than the state. I mean, oftentimes in the criminal system these days, it's almost like the state is aloof from either this person they're punishing or the person that's been injured, or the community that's affected by the defendant's action. And restorative justice tries to get all of those parties. And the ones that are most impacted by the actions of the state are typically the defendant and the victim and the community. I mean, those people are just kind of left out of the system right now. It all comes down to the prosecutor and the defense attorney typically working out a plea bargain. But restorative justice tries to get the most interested parties, the defendant, the community, the injured person together, and figure out, you know, how both can we make wrong things right, and how can we keep this from happening in the future? And I think there's great promise in that.
Some people would argue that restorative justice is too soft. What's your view of that?
Well, I think restorative justice can be hard. I mean, I think defendants oftentimes, and it's, restorative justice doesn't work in every situation, but defendants that are confronted with the story of what's happened to a victim at a more personal level, I think are likely to feel their pain. It's likely to impact their life, and it's likely to be very tough. I tell some stories in the book, of course, about restorative justice and its impact.
One of the things that's puzzled me is how lawyers represent guilty clients. This has always fascinated me. And I wonder how can lawyers represent guilty clients, and should lawyers represent guilty clients?
Well, of course, the glib answer is, well, we're all guilty,
True.
which at certain at a certain very significant level, of course, is true. But lawyers need to, I think, see themselves as part of a system that seeks to achieve justice. And within this system, I mean, the system has evolved over many years, and I think it's a system that's grounded in practical wisdom, the theory of the system. And I think my experience is in a fallen world, it's a terrific system, but it's an advocacy system where I, as a client, might be representing someone I know is guilty, a prosecutor. Maybe is prosecuting to try and achieve just punishment, and we're making our arguments before a judge or a jury or both. And I think the system really helps that judge and that jury to make a wise decision. The way I like to put it is a lawyer is pursuing justice indirectly. In a context like that, each of the lawyers is doing that. You do your part, and I think the system is most likely to yield justice. And of course, in most situations, the police wouldn't be prosecuting, the prosecutor wouldn't be prosecuting unless they had very good evidence. So your job, in fact, as a defense attorney is trying to identify things about this client that might justify a reduced sentence from where it might otherwise be. And I'll say one more thing. I mean, that's sort of the systemic argument, but as far as the personal relationship between you and a client, this is a situation that really calls for love. I mean, we're told that even Jesus advocates for us before the Father. I mean, I wonder if he's ever accused of of representing guilty clients.
Surely not.
I mean, we make our argument. I mean, and I handled two murder cases and some situations that were really horrific. But I felt like, I mean, particularly in one of the cases I had, that I was the only one on, this guy's side, the only one that stood with him when he was asked to stand and plead guilty or not guilty, or for argument to be made on his behalf. And I felt like it was an honor to do so.
And everyone is entitled to a fair trial, aren't they? That's how the system works. What does the Bible have to say about litigation?
Well, you don't have a litigation system that looks, exactly like ours. There are situations that kind of make reference without a detailed description of what it looks like. In one verse, we're told, don't make your decisions too quickly. Apparently, speaking to a judge or a jury, don't decide a decision after you've heard only one side make its argument. Be open to the argument of the other side. That's a little hint of an advocacy system, maybe somewhat like we have. Of course, you've got the wonderful description of Solomon in the case where he's trying to decide custody as between two prostitutes that are, deeply attached to the child that that they're arguing over, and he uses a bit of tricky wisdom to determine between the two that that looks a bit like a legal system. And of course, Moses is approached by his father-in-law, and he says, you're just spending too much time caught up with these with deciding everything yourself. Choose wise people to serve as justice. So we get hints of a legal system in the Old Testament that that appears to be a just one. Of course, in the New Testament, we see Jesus and his trial, and we see many of the
Ah,
apostles.
yes. Now there's an unjust trial if ever there was one. Let's find some evidence on the day of the hearing. Have we got any evidence? Let's make some up.
And so we've got plenty of examples in the Bible of just legal systems, just trials, and unjust ones as well.
Yes. Is it ever appropriate for a Christian to use the courts? I mean, I've had a number of conversations over the years with folk who are adamant as Christians that we should never go to law. Now, I was fascinated, absolutely fascinated to read the section in your book about this. I think you offer great wisdom on the subject, really. Is it ever appropriate for a Christian to use the courts?
Well, we have statements that Jesus made that certainly could be used both, I think, to suggest people shouldn't bring suits themselves and should not defend themselves when they're sued. And if we take those literally, I mean, I think we can make a pretty good argument that that we shouldn't use the courts. But I think in those cases, as Jesus often did, he was using hyperbole. He was giving us a shocking statement, such as, hate your mother and hate your father and your brother and your sister. Obviously, we're not intended to do those. Those are intended to grab our attention, and they need to grab our attention. I think we should be hesitant to bring suit, and even have hesitant to defend ourselves. But the overall picture that Jesus gives is the overall lesson, the overall ethic is one of loving your neighbor, trying to do what is in his or her best interest. And I think in the context of litigation, that should be the question that we ask. Now, it's a tough question. As I quote in the book, John Calvin dealt with that
He was a
in a
lawyer. He
he
was a
was
lawyer.
he was a lawyer, and I suspect a very good one,
I think I would have thought formidable.
given how wise he is and how well he writes. But he addresses this, and I spend a good bit of time in the book analyzing his thought on that. And really, he was the one that caught my attention with this notion of, use the courts. I mean, he points to Romans 13. God has appointed the magistrate for your good. Well, if God's appointing the judge, he intends you, in some cases at least, to use the judge. But Calvin says, the overall question is the person's heart. Now, he says a righteous litigant is almost nowhere to be found in this day. Of course, he was speaking 500 years ago. Seems to me like he could have been speaking in this day, today, because so many people go into litigation with anger and hatred in their heart. And addressing that, of course, is a challenge. And I mean, I think a Christian lawyer can help enable a client to do that.
And what do we do, I wonder, when the church is the offender? I mean, I'm thinking about all the recent one, and not so recent, going way, way back, the sexual abuse, for example.
Wow, yeah, that's a very tough question. And were I representing someone who was a victim of sexual abuse in situations like that, I would have hesitated to bring suit and would have encouraged the client to do so as well. At the same time, great harm has been done. And I think both in the sexual abuse and I'm afraid in litigation itself, as unfortunately churches have stonewalled and denied wrongdoing in situations where, we've now discovered and I think been surprised at how extensive the harm was. And I praise the plaintiff's lawyers who have doggedly pursued churches, and I think were it not for their work, a lot of abuse would still be going on. And I praise God for some of the guardrails that have been put up, and unfortunately, I'm afraid more may need to be put up.
Yes, for sure, I would say. You have a chapter in your book, I think, if I remember rightly, about the pitfalls or the dangers of law school and legal practice. And this fascinated me too. What are some of the dangers or pitfalls that you see? I mean, you've had a long career. What are the dangers or pitfalls of law school and legal practice?
Well, there's several in this, and really throughout the book. The book is just full of specific challenges to lawyers that I try and address. But in this final chapter, I try and address challenges, I think what I would call challenges to the heart. And of course, Jesus often spoke of those challenges. I'll identify a few. These, by the way, I think are just part of law practice. There's no real escaping them. One is the risk of depersonalizing or dehumanizing even clients. In law school, you go in that first week and you learn about personal injury cases and torts, which I taught, or criminal law victims that have been injured, and you're just horrified by the descriptions of the of what they've suffered, and it weighs on your heart. And then by the end of your first year, you've read a thousand of cases like this, and you sort of zip right through them. And I remember one of my friends who's a law professor. He said after a while, they were kind of zipping along in criminal law, and one of the students raised her hand and she said, "Is there a place in criminal law for lament? Isn't
Huh?
that a wonderful biblical concept?" All
Very
the other
much so.
students are just zipping along. What's the rule of law? How can we apply it? But this is a student who was touched by that. And that happens in law school, but I think it also happens in law practice. You represent so many clients, and so this becomes just one more severed arm, or one more dispute over a family trust. But I think we have to work to maintain the view of people as persons. Lawyers, as I've mentioned earlier, are in an advocacy system. And in that advocacy system, you are called on to be a vigorous advocate for your client. And if you're not careful, that advocacy can take over your personality. And the next thing, you're arguing with your spouse or you're arguing with your neighbor. You won't back down. Well, arguing and not backing down may be part of your role as a lawyer. It shouldn't take over your life.
Yes,
So
absolutely. Fa
those are a couple.
yeah, absolutely fascinating. I think that's pretty much our half hour. Robert Cochrane Jr., the author of this new InterVarsity Press IVP America book called The Servant Lawyer, Facing the Challenges of Christian Faith and Everyday Law Practice. Oh, I meant to ask you, Robert, before we go, you write that the book is for everyday lawyers. What is an everyday lawyer? And is any lawyer really just an everyday lawyer?
Well, I describe everyday lawyers as lawyers from Main Street to Wall Street. And it would involve lawyers who are involved in litigation and business practice. The thing I want to emphasize is that we address the challenges that almost every ordinary lawyer would face. So much focus within Christian circles is on the lawyers that are battling for global justice or battling for life or representing people in groups in religious freedom cases. And, you know, these are wonderful lawyers. It may be that an everyday lawyer will occasionally get a case like this, but not that many lawyers are handling cases at that level. Most lawyers are representing the ordinary client that walks in through the door. And what I want to emphasize in the book is that these lawyers are called by God to do what they do and are doing a significant thing in God's world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so get a copy of the book if you're a lawyer, and even if you're not, if you're like me, have friends who are in the law and Christian friends who are in the law, and I've enjoyed many, many discussions about faith and law with my Christian legal friends. They're absolutely fabulous. Get hold of a copy. And thank you, Robert, for your time and wisdom, and thank you to our creative team at Liquid Edge who sponsor this podcast and to take care of things behind the scenes. Robert, bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
Thanks for listening to the God Story podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a review and make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss the next one. Links to the books and topics mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes, and you can discover bonus episodes on our Patreon page. As always, you can get in touch via our website, godstorypodcast.com. That's godstorypodcast.com.